Welcome to The Political Scene, a show about current events and the political forces driving them. I'm Tyler Foggett, a senior editor at The New Yorker. Supposedly, things in Hollywood have been changing for women and for people of color. After the Me Too and Black Lives Matter movements, leaders in the entertainment industry promised a lot. New kinds of stories were going to be told by newly diverse writers, showrunners, and casts. In short, Hollywood's long history of sexism and discrimination was going to be reckoned with. But as studios have shifted with changing social expectations, there's been talk of a backlash within Hollywood. Actors and studio execs, who were previously worried about getting canceled by their progressive fans, have expressed feelings of fatigue. My colleague, Doreen St. Felix, a staff writer who was previously The New Yorker's television critic, has spent a lot of time thinking about the culture war, entertainment, and politics. Hi, Doreen.
Hi, Tyler.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So the other day we were working on a piece and you said something to me that I found very interesting, which is that you don't think that cancel culture is real. I guess like in these parts, you know, that's still a hot take. So I thought we could start this conversation by having you define what cancel culture or cancellation typically means when people talk about it. And then maybe you could go on to explain why you don't believe in it.
So I think if you are like me and you watch a lot of reality television, it's probably the case that your first encounters with the idea of cancellation in the mainstream are probably on like really sort of campy shows like Real Housewives, maybe even RuPaul's Drag Race. And so when I think about like the true origins of the idea of cancellation, they're not necessarily based in seriousness. I think canceling someone is definitely, it's kind of like a mode of like sociability that I associate with like Black spaces, queer spaces, spaces where people, obviously it's predicated on community, but there is like a kind of, I don't know, jocularity in the idea that like someone would do something that was a little off color, off base, and it would cause a reaction from like the main group to be like, you're canceled. Mm-hmm. But of course, it didn't have like actual policing repercussions in the way that people sort of imagine cancellation to be. And so it's interesting because then like, I hate using this phrase, but it is really useful. During the Me Too era, there became to be this notion that, a lot of the times like, phrases or ideas migrate from really particular niche spaces. They get eaten up by the mainstream and they lose their nuance. And so all of a sudden we were ascribing what is like a fairly, I would say, normal thing that happens in culture, which is that the masses decide that they are no longer down with the behavior or the politics or the ideas of a certain person and they decide to abandon that person. That's something that happens. You know, we attribute it to social media, but that happens throughout history. All of a sudden, because there was like a lot of investment in, I think, depicting people who use social media as being insurrectionists, as people who threaten the status quo, all of a sudden you have this idea that cancellation is now a culture and therefore a movement. And so that's what I think I take real issue with, is that there's no real like consolidated I would say group of people who A, even have the power to take certain people out of the status quo and then B, to like banish them or, you know, and as we've seen in the cases of many of these figures, a lot of them have been able to come back, whatever that means. You know, I was looking at the nominations for Best Comedy Album mm-hmm. for the Grammys and it's like Louis C.K., Dave Chappelle, all people who are notionally canceled and yet seem to be like flourishing.
That's funny. So I was recently talking to my boyfriend's mom about the idea of cancel culture and mm-hmm. she had totally sort of misunderstood the phrase. Like she thought that the idea was that we were like canceling culture and that's what people were, and I feel like it was actually like, kind of like, in a way it was almost like an apt misreading where I was like, is the mm-hmm. result of cancel culture that you are like canceling culture in the sense that you were like, mm-hmm. you know, this idea has sort of, I guess, like narrowed the realm of like acceptable discourse in a way. Like, because I think that, you know, even if like there is no like, you know, Cancel Incorporated or whatever that's like out to, you know, like police celebrities or make sure that they're not getting, you know, nominations and whatnot, like it does seem like people are really afraid of being canceled, or maybe they're afraid of just like widespread social media backlash, and then they're using canceled as like a shorthand to describe that. But like it does seem as though people are, you know, sort of, you know, operating as though cancel culture is real or real to some extent.
Exactly. And I think paradoxically, that's what makes it real. When you have a sense of a censorship that is maybe even done like before the artwork or the phenomenon even meets the culture. Mm-hmm. I think about the reaction that Taylor Swift, there was a music video that she made to accompany her latest album. And in one of the songs, she's talking about like, you know, her issues with body image. And in the music video, she steps on a scale and the ticker, it sort of tilts to the word fat. And there were a lot of people who read that as being fat phobic.
And then she had to take the thing out of the video, right?
She took it out of the video, but I feel like the question is like, did Taylor Swift have to do that?
And I would say, I mean, she's someone who like has been very vocal about like her struggle with eating disorders. It seems very clear that that was supposed to be like her depiction of like what it's like to be inside of her own body and to think that she's fat even when she's clearly not. It wasn't supposed to be like a standard setter for like what the acceptable weight for women is, but people were really upset by it.
Yeah, and I think another analog to that might be on Beyoncé's latest album, Renaissance, she used the word spaz, which is, you know, a slur, and a lot of disabled activists have spoken out against the mainstreaming of that word, especially in like music lyrics. It's a word that really comes up there. And I was really surprised to see Beyoncé take that out because she seems to never really bend to fan power.
There were like a few things on that album though. Like there was the Kellis sample. Like I think there's been this trend lately of like celebrities like Beyoncé who seem almost untouchable, like editing their stuff after the fact, which also just opens up the question of like, is it weird that we live in a society where like you put out an album and then someone criticizes it in some way and then you like delete a song off of it or you change it? Like I think that things used to just be more permanent in a way, but now we have the ability to edit everything to make sure that like our fan bases are, you know, pleased with every single aspect of it, which I don't know, to me isn't that fun, but
it's not fun. And it's also not a great it's not a great impetus for making art.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I'm 30 years old now, but when this like notion entered culture, I was 25. And I think not to ascribe it to being hot-headed and young, but when I was younger, I definitely was a lot more amenable to the idea that like famous people had to answer for anything that offended me. Mm-hmm. And now that I get a bit older, it's like offense is a perfectly normal reaction to be had. It shouldn't, in my mind, make that artist like no longer tolerable to the person who loves them. But of course, we're talking about in the case of art making, obviously cancellation or the paranoia around it is in a lot of other spheres where I think the circumstances are more serious.
That inclination that you mentioned having when you were younger to like sort of want to hold these powerful people accountable or to hear them answer for these things that they disagreed with you on, where do you think that came from?
That's such a great question. Well, I think I joined social media probably when I was in high school. I actually got a notification from Twitter like a couple weeks ago. That was like, it's your 13th year on this platform.
And then they show you like your first tweet, which is like the world's worst selfie or something.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you delete it immediately. But I think the way it shaped my late adolescence and I guess early adulthood was, as corny as it sounded, as it sounds to put it this way, it shaped my idea of like what it meant to have a voice, right? Mm-hmm. So if I say something and then I decide to publish it, that has heft and perhaps maybe even equal heft to a famous person saying it. And I think there were a lot of benefits to that, I guess you could say, dynamic that was created in the early 2010s, where people who never usually have to deal with figures or phenomenon that are outside of their really small social circles all of a sudden did have to deal with them. But at the same time, it ended up creating, I think, this really untenable cycle where everything became meta and like this notion. It's funny, like when we're writing, we always try to avoid the word discourse, right? Because the idea is that discourse...
We hate it.
We hate it because it's like not real. But this past decade taught us that discourse has really developed a solidity and a weight. And so often, sometimes you're talking about the discourse about the thing before you even talk about the thing itself, whether that's a film or some sort of controversy. And social media is what tips like a natural human interaction in the world of celebrity into something that feels newsworthy even, let alone like all the other philosophical issues with it.
And why do you think that Twitter in particular has been at the center of this so much? Like I was thinking about, all the stuff with Kanye West and how like, right. I mean, he'd been saying a lot of inflammatory things on Instagram. And then all of a sudden he tweeted the DEFCON 3 thing on Twitter. And that seemed to be when like the, you know, sort of like larger public became aware of, you know, sort of how inflammatory his comments had gotten. And I guess I'm just curious about, like, especially now that we have, like, Elon Musk buying Twitter, partly because he himself has said that he is concerned about
right.
cancel culture and, like, limits on free speech. Like, do you think that it's correct that Twitter is, like, at the center of this conversation? Or do you think that actually it's, like, a social media problem in general and that Twitter is just, like, one place where maybe we see a lot of these, like, sort of, like, battles taking place?
That's really fascinating. Well, I think every social media platform developed its own culture. And Instagram is not, it doesn't run on outrage.
Instagram is a platform for agreement, yeah.
Exactly, for agreement, for consensus, for fantasy. And Twitter is a platform for dissent, anger, depression, all these things. That's why writers like Twitter more than they like Instagram. And so I think there's a way in which the tweet, especially after Trump, became like the tweet itself became a metaphor for political speech. And so I think on Instagram, Kanye West is still just a musician. But I think on Twitter, he is considered to be a proto-fascist or perhaps someone who might run for president. Like, he has different identities on each of these platforms.
That's a good point. And it might even have something to do with the way that Instagram, like, centers photos. And so it's like,
right.
if Kanye posts, you know, something alongside a photo, it almost feels like art. Whereas on Twitter, it's just the words. And that feels like more of a political statement.
Exactly. And I think I've noticed, I know we're talking about Twitter, but I almost want to pivot to talk about Instagram a little bit because I think Instagram... I'm remembering, you know, 2 years ago during the uprisings, there was that effort to post a black square to show your solidarity
oh, yeah.
with the Black Lives Matter movement and how it sort of, it showed how Instagram is like insufficient for making a political statement because it ended up creating this scenario where a hashtag where people, you know, were able to access information about what was going on became flooded with black squares. And so in many ways, it was a social media blackout. And so I think Instagram is, to use slang that I've heard my younger cousins use, it's really unserious. but having been through a presidency in which so much of it was conducted on Twitter, obviously it has, I think people think of it as being a kind of like real violence in the way that I don't think they think of other platforms, which is incredible because there are platforms that are literally dedicated to hate speech, you know, that are funded by right-wing like tech people and all that.
And I mean, Kanye himself has said that he's going to buy Parler, which is one of the right-wing platforms. Although it seems like that's kind of unnecessary now that Elon Musk has bought Twitter. And now that...
and now they're back. Kanye has been unbanned. Trump has been unbanned.
So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how cancel culture or either, like the threat of cancel culture, like the boogeyman of cancel culture animates a lot of decisions in Hollywood and among celebrities who seem, you know, in my opinion, they seem pretty freaked out about it.
Remember, there was definitely like a 3 or 4 year period where what every famous person who was interviewed was asked what they thought about cancel culture. And it became...
Oh, God.
I think it became an interesting kind of like barometer of where celebrity in general is. Because you had like a lot of people who were more down to earth.
You probably figured out who the real celebrities were.
100%. You know, you had... That's the risk that you take with making art and making art that makes you famous. And so I really do doubt that most artists, true artists, are really putting that censorious impulse in making their work. I think there's like a real, the celebrity class had been so endeared to its public for the past 15 years. And I think it's really useful to see that figment of solidarity get dissipated. And like, ultimately, I am interested in celebrities like saying what it is that they believe, because I don't have an investment in them as being like good people. I have an investment in them as being interesting people. What I'm curious about is whether our culture can move to tolerating that again, because we have seen the havoc that a celebrity who is a bad person can wreak, right? Like, we're all traumatized from Donald Trump. And so as I get older, I really do realize, I'm like, sometimes you do kind of have to like listen to or consume something made by someone who is like very obviously racist or very obviously sexist or whatever. And that doesn't necessarily like preclude their work from including a truth. And I think that that was a conversation we never really resolved during Me Too. You know, we never really resolved the Cosby question, the Polanski question. And it's something that like, it like gets at me, because I know what I'm supposed to believe, but I know that I hold opinions that like directly contradict my own belief system when it comes to art and the monsters that make it.
We'll have more with Doreen St. Felix in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So just thinking about like celebrities and whether they actually matter, I feel like that's something that you touched on in your recent piece about the LA mayoral race between Rick Caruso and Karen Bass, who won. But there were a bunch of celebrities who sort of got involved in the race just in terms of like endorsements and also shooting ads with both candidates. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about just like the two candidates and what they represented, and then also the celebrities who aligned themselves with either side.
Of course. So I'm not an Angeleno, so I will definitely be speaking from broad strokes. But Karen Bass, she had led the CBC, the Congressional Black Caucus, real like native Los Angeles politician, set up this campaign that seemed like the natural progression of what was happening in the city at the time, which was to say that she would be the first Black woman to be elected mayor of Los Angeles. Her campaign actually, there are like a lot of similarities in terms of what the Caruso and the Bass campaign were running on.
Yeah, it was hard to tell them apart sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of using the homelessness crisis in Los Angeles to, I would say, re-entrench some really NIMBY ideas of what you're supposed to do with your houseless neighbors. Also, Karen wanted to get more money for the LAPD, and Caruso had those same positions, but to a much, much larger extreme, and very much ran on a law and order, anti-homeless, I'm going to make you a lot of money stance. It's really interesting as a case study of like what's going on in Hollywood right now, because there were some celebrities who were endorsing Caruso who had not endorsed a candidate at all in the past presidential election. And so the idea that like this culture war was coming close to home inspired them to kind of speak out in a certain way was like fascinating. Chris Pratt is someone who, you know, he's in these Marvel movies, which obviously have an association with conservative politics. His fans have been like really mad about how kind of like right-y he can be. But he didn't endorse Donald Trump. He's smart enough to not do that, right? And yet, when it comes to Caruso, he had this like really impassioned post on Instagram. And then there are other figures too, like Gwyneth Paltrow.
Hi, I'm Gwyneth Paltrow. And I think we really need a leader who can come in and has the strength to solve some really tough problems. So that is why I am endorsing my old friend Rick Caruso for mayor.
And yeah, we were just fascinated by this little micro moment in celebrity cultural politics. It speaks to this idea that there might be an exhaustion with placating fan standards. Because the thing about celebrities is like they might not be that savvy, but their teams definitely are. And so I don't think that anyone who decided to like come out to support Caruso, I don't think they were ignorant of the sort of reactions that they would get.
They just didn't care.
They just didn't care. And that's like new. I think celebrities have cared almost embarrassingly too much over the past decade about, you know, being on the right side of history.
It is kind of a fascinating change from what we've seen even just like in the past few years. Like if you look at, there's either been like a widespread shift toward progressivism or like a widespread desire to align oneself with what is considered progressive in Hollywood and also just like in other corporate organizations. Like I'm thinking about like individual people, but also like, I don't know, I'm thinking about like how after like the, you know, Black Lives Matter protests in the summer of 2020, I was getting emails from my gym saying that, you know, like we stand with like the people who, you know, are protesting in the streets right now, like just kind of like rando organizations that were like lining up to sort of be on the right side of history. I'm wondering like what sort of things you notice, like both in like everyday life, but also from your perspective as like the magazine's television critic at the time, like in terms of like the kinds of projects that were being greenlit. Like, Doreen, how did Hollywood change?
Well, that's such an amazing question because I became the television critic, I think, in January of 2020. 2020, sorry, why did I say it like that? January 2020. And then, like, 2 months later, it was the pandemic. And then 2 months later, it was the uprising. And so you got to see the industry have to decide whether or not they were going to acknowledge these two realities. And very famously, it took television in particular a very long time to acknowledge the pandemic. And most of television didn't acknowledge it at all. I think it was like Law and Order that was one of the first shows to have a mask on television. But we didn't see that same hesitancy with the uprisings, I would say, not only in the shows themselves, but also just like and the statements that actors would make, that showrunners would make, that networks would make. Yeah, and so you had this kind of, I don't know if wave is the right word because I'd have to look at the numbers. I think it probably was a lot less than media maybe wanted it to seem. But yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people whose shows started to get greenlit. There were people who were being brought into rooms that they were never being brought into before. And it's an incredibly, it's like very, I don't know, like kind of Percival Everett's satire vibes because it's like, this is a political issue. It's a cultural issue as well, but it's a political issue. It has to do with the police and this cultural institution with all this money and all this power decides to like fix it by focusing on representation. And I think it created like definitely a lot of existential crises, not only amongst the creators, but amongst the consumers, where it was just like, what is this line where people are being murdered by the police state? How does that turn into this network greenlighting a TV show? It just feels, I think, really representative of America's really deep, almost like quasi-religious obsession with needing culture to fix political issues.
And I wonder how much of it is connected to sort of like the Me Too movement and the fact that that was something that was so, I mean, not like uniquely Hollywood, but like it was something that Hollywood definitely felt. And it kind of like originated with Hollywood. If you take, you know, the Harvey Weinstein story as like sort of the big thing that kicked that off. And so maybe the film and entertainment industry was just very like aware of like the steps that it needed to take after the Me Too movement and like took some of those steps, like in terms of offering sexual harassment training and, you know, like hiring more women and that kind of thing. And then when there was this like racial reckoning, they also felt as though they had to deal with it directly, even though that was like less, you know, about them.
Right. Yeah, that's a really, I think, amazing point. And I think it also speaks to how young Hollywood is, like how, yeah. like relatively when you compare it to other cultural institutions.
I thought they were all old.
But, you know, you're dealing with like 110 years of history. And for much of that history, there wasn't really an incentive to diversify, an incentive to sort of take accountability. You know, this is an industry like that very famously blacklisted artists in the 50s and the 60s. You know, there was a Hays Code. And so I think Hollywood really benefits from how murky and shadowy the business is, because its vision, its picture is so telegenic. It's just like a bunch of beautiful people in beautiful dresses, like walking down red carpets and acting. Whereas the business itself, it's like, I mean, the first feature film in America was a film about, you know, adulating white supremacy. And so it's almost like it's original sin, you know, more so than like any other artwork that exists. Hollywood is like based in and rooted in misogyny, racism, and white supremacy. And so these kind of like quick fixes are never going to fix an ideology, you know?
Yeah. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on how, like, whether Hollywood's attempts to rectify its like wrongdoings in the past, like what, like whether they have actually resulted in like better television. I mean, I edited a lot of your columns from, you know, sort of during that period in which, you know, shows were trying to, you know, spotlight more creators of color, you know, have more main characters of color, that sort of thing. And like, when you watch television, I guess like my first question would be like, did you notice that like there were different kinds of people who were being spotlit in shows? Or was it more like there was like one black co-protagonist, but like for the most part, it was like the same show that it would have been otherwise? I guess like that would be the first question, is like, was there actually more diversity on screen? And then the second is, were the shows like better quality? Or does it seem like there is actually something that, like a whitewashing that happened when Hollywood was trying to like mainstream stories about queer and black people and not necessarily always doing this by hiring black and queer writers?
So I think for the first part of your question, I was most interested in that shift when it came to network television, because I think network television is like where most viewers are. You know, the most watched show in America is The Big Bang Theory. It's not White Lotus. It's not Succession.
Is it really still The Big Bang Theory? I thought it was like The Simpsons.
No, it's definitely not The Simpsons. Simpsons at this point is
I can live with The Simpsons. I can't live with The Big Bang Theory.
No, I mean, I watch it sometimes. It's a comfort food. But that's all to say that like, we always like euphemize this time in cultural production in the mid-2000s as like the Obama era. And like a perfect show for that era was like Modern Family, right? Where it was three interconnected families and like some of them aren't white and some of them are gay and some of them are adopted. And they had this sort of like really cool, sarcastic, but ultimately like optimistic view about the future of America. But then Modern Family ends, right? And like Blackish is another show that's kind of like out the door. I feel like I'm noticing that network television, like, it doesn't, the more I think atomized culture is, especially in the age of the internet, you can feel network television kind of like losing its grasp on how to like recreate another Modern Family moment. There isn't really a show that's like filling that gap. If anything, I think people are becoming a lot more invested in like competition reality TV shows. And there have definitely been like on Survivor and other shows, like some huge racial controversies in which it felt that contestants were brought in to diversify the lineup, but then were like treated really badly or judged unfairly. And so I think looking in that space is kind of interesting, because reality TV also gets produced on a faster clip. So those people really do have to react to, okay, what do people want to see on their TV? What are we doing too little of? Another example might be Bravo with its like Housewives universe.
It always comes back to the Housewives.
It always comes back to the Housewives for me. That really is like my urtext. But they end up creating like a completely new series that's like based all around Black women. And it's set in the DC area. And it does feel a little bit like, okay, they're reading the tea leaves and feel like they are noticing that there's a real hunger for that representation on television. But I would say, like, honestly, the way that we talk about what's changing in culture never really matches up to what's actually happening. Like, in my experience watching television, I was watching a lot of the same post-male anti-hero, you know, kind of stories. I think because it takes so long to make TV, I didn't really feel like, oh, there was a true injection of, like, quote-unquote, new voices or Black voices. It felt like a lot of the statements that were made were lip service. And then you hear about, like, projects falling apart, you know, this show getting canceled, that kind of thing. So I don't know how sincere those efforts really were.
I see. So you don't think that rather than there being like an influx of like people of color and, you know, queer people working on these shows and writing them and whatnot, it was more like, was it like optics, but it wasn't actually, were they diversifying the shows without actually bringing in any diversity to write the shows?
Yeah. So that's something I don't know, like, exactly how the writer's room, I would say, machine breaks down. But even just in terms of friends that I have anecdotally who work in television, many of them had experiences where all of a sudden they were being brought into meetings. And then once the heat kind of cooled down and there was like less pressure for this company or this showrunner to express solidarity, the meetings would drop off. And, you know, there are studies that show how, like, oppressively white and male the showrunner system is, which is where, that's really where the change begins. It's meaningful to bring in writers from different backgrounds to a show, but it really matters when the showrunner is an Issa Rae or someone who is saying, okay, I'm going to make this room, like, all Black or, you know, Reservation Dogs. I'm going to have all Native actors to play on it. So we have like some shining examples, but I don't think systemically much changed.
What you were saying about basically as soon as like the pressure being alleviated, the showrunner just kind of like going back to basics sort of reminded me of this recent piece in the New York Times about how there's been this like creeping backlash in Hollywood from both executives and celebrities about to a lot of the changes that were put in place after the Me Too movement. There were execs who were quoted in the piece basically saying that there's this fatigue when it comes to like progressive reform these days. And one of the examples in the piece was about the movie Batgirl. It was a Warner Brothers movie, Batgirl. It had this very diverse cast. I believe that the main actress was Latina. And then I think that one of the supporting actors was trans. I know that it was produced by women and it was directed by two Muslim men. And the movie was very nearly finished. They showed it to some test audiences. It didn't do too well. And then Warner Brothers announced that they would be shelving it and basically taking the tax write-off because it would be more expensive to, like, advertise the thing and, like, you know, show it everywhere and then have it just, you know, be like a box office flop. You know, Warner Brothers, I think that their justification for shelving it was that they found the movie to be creatively lacking. But then there was someone quoted in this Times piece who basically said, like, there's a recession when, you know, budgets get tighter. The first thing to go is, you know, diversity or like the diversity projects. And that just kind of reminded me of what you were just saying about sort of like the anecdotal thing that you heard from one of your friends, which is that like when push comes to shove, like diversity is like kind of like the first thing to fall by the wayside.
Absolutely. And then it's like this paradox because it's like, of course, the market value is going down because you're not putting out more of these films or these television projects that are rooted in whatever we mean by diversity. And you talking about the Batgirl controversy reminds me of, I mean, it's like if you wanted a perfect case study, it's Ezra Miller with The Flash. They seem to be going through some sort of psychological crisis. And it seems so clear to me that this person is no longer valuable in the market. And yeah, as far as I know, at least as of last month, Ezra was like photographed still shooting scenes for The Flash. And yet Batgirl gets, you know, shown to test audiences and there's like allegedly, you know, a less than hoped for response, which what does that even mean? We don't know. And it gets canned. And I think of all the times where, you know, there will be some show that is buried on a network, maybe even a show like Southside, which we did a column on last year. It had been on Comedy Central, and then it moved to HBO Max. And it was one of those things where it was like, it very clearly didn't have a large advertising budget. But then the word of mouth happens. And then all of a sudden, it's like the biggest show. And that's all everyone is talking about. And there are a lot of those instances where you can feel that a property that is either written by marginalized people or focuses on marginalized life, you can tell that property is like not getting the A-list treatment. And then they end up blowing everything out of the water. Even, I mean, Black Panther is a huge movie, but like the amount of money that Ryan Coogler made at a time where people are no longer even going to the theater is just like massive.
Yeah. They really pulled out all the stops for that one. I mean, they got like Rihanna to like restart her music career. I mean, it's like...
Exactly. And I mean, the cast and everything. But remember when that was initially announced, there was like a lot of racist pushback from comic fans who, you know, who questioned Coogler, who questioned Chadwick Boseman, who's passed away, all this, whatever. And then now look, it's like one of the biggest films of all time.
You know, when the New York Times talks about like the woke backlash in Hollywood, which really just seems like Hollywood being freaked out because some projects like Batgirl and like Bros, you know, didn't do very well.
Oh God,
well.
Bros.
I mean, a lot of people are quick to be like, oh, like this is, you know, backlash or this is, you know, it's like another market decision. But like, I feel like in those, I mean, you saw Bros, it sounds like. Did you like it?
I did not love Bros, but I also thought that it was, I think each side of the conversation was so really missing the forest for the trees. Because, you know, you had the creators who felt like homophobia was the reason why people hadn't seen this film.
Yeah.
And then you have the sort of like money people who were like, people don't like watching like gay cinema, so we're not going to make more movies like this. There was this sort of speculation that that would be the reaction. When it's like, sometimes it's just not that serious. Sometimes the movie isn't that good.
Yeah.
And people are not drawn to it.
There was a lot of talk about like how telling it was that people hated Bros but loved Top Gun Maverick, which was like sort of, you know, unabashedly anti-woke. But it's like, I saw Top Gun Maverick. I loved it. Sometimes like the anti-woke movie is just like kind of good. I don't know. And sometimes like the more progressive movie isn't great. And I feel like, as you were saying, like Hollywood should know at this point, like what will be good and what will be bad. And obviously like throwing money at, you know, a diversity project that is almost like doomed to fail because like the people who are involved in it hate the idea is just not.
Yeah. And I think also that comparison, I remember that was a sort of comparison that arose, just didn't make sense on a lot of levels because it's like Top Gun is an existing property. Tom Cruise is.
He's an existing property.
He's an existing property. And I think also, you know, action films do tend to bring in much larger crowds than romantic comedies. You know, the way that woke has become like a genre is also what kind of like impoverishes that conversation.
Yeah.
I like, was Bros really woke? I don't know. Because it looked like too, it looked very like white males, you know, sort of like centric in that way. And in some ways was like conservative. I mean, but yeah, it's, and we always, whenever conversations get reductive like that, I think what's most interesting in the conversations that ensue after these failures or these successes is kind of the hyperbole and the total willingness to erase history in order to make like a pretty facile and I would say impermanent political point.
Thank you so much, Doreen.
Thank you so much for having me, Tyler. It was great chatting with you, as always.
Doreen St. Felix is a staff writer who writes about culture, politics, and television. You can find more of her writing on NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Michelle Moses, with help from Sydney Cobb. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thank you so much for listening.